All right. Good evening and welcome to Second Opinion. Clinical investigators provide perspectives on the future role of AKT inhibition in the management of prostate cancer. I'm Dr. Elizabeth Heath, and I will be your moderator for this meeting today, this evening. I am joined today by two esteemed colleagues. One is Professor Karim Fazazi, who is from formerly the Institut Gustave Roussy, but currently is now at the Centre Oscar Lambert in France. I'm also joined by Dr. Daniel George from Duke University. And for just our conversations to be as casual as possible, we are going to address each other by our first names. So Karim, Dan, thank you. And we welcome your participation as well this evening. In order to make this meeting more relevant to participants, Research to Practice President Dr. Neil Love conducted video interviews with Dr. Niraj Agarwal from the University of Utah Huntsman Cancer Center and Dr. Raina McKay from the Moores Cancer Center of the University of California, San Diego. Now, excerpts from these interviews will be shown throughout the program, and our faculty will provide a second opinion. So we will also refer to them as Niraj and Raina. Here are our faculty disclosures, and we will just run through these. Wonderful. We'd like to acknowledge the commercial support for this evening's program. It is supported by an educational grant from AstraZeneca, and as well as a thank you to the Research to Practice CME Planning Committee members, staff, and reviewers. This group of scientific staff, planners, and independent reviewers for Research to Practice have no relevant conflicts of interest. Importantly, this educational activity tonight contains discussion of a non-FDA-approved use of agents and regimens, so please refer to the official prescribing information for each product for their approved indications. So, here we are this evening to have a very interesting conversation about this idea of the future role of AKT inhibition in the management of prostate cancer. And this is our agenda. We will have three modules this evening. The first is going to talk about clinical implications and appropriate strategies to identify P10 deficiency in prostate cancer, and that will be led by Dan. Module two will be targeting AKT in metastatic prostate cancer, and that discussion will be led by Karim. And then module three will be a discussion about tolerability and other practical consideration with capivasertib, and you will hear that from me. So, we are going to move this forward, and I'm going to now hand this over to Dan to talk about your module. Go ahead, Dan.
Thank you, Elizabeth. Thank you all for coming this evening and enjoying, hopefully, informative information about what we see as really kind of an important target in prostate cancer, one that's been around for a long period of time that we haven't really taken advantage of. And I hope in this session I can kind of walk you through that background information around this this genetic alteration in what we call P10 deficiency, its biologic and clinical implications. Okay. Let's start a little bit broadly to start here around biomarkers, because I think, you know, when we think of prostate cancer and where we are today, already in practice, we have a number of validated biomarkers that we're using. And first and foremost, germline genetic testing. If you look at our guidelines, it's recommended for patients that have family history or high-risk localized or metastatic disease. Really should be at this point in time now something that we're routinely or systematically performing in patients who meet those criteria. And in addition to that, somatic genetic testing. This is not one or the other, really both, and particularly for patients with metastatic prostate cancer, multi-gene assessments looking in particular for homologous recombinant repair defects as well as MSI high or mismatch repair defects. So these are known genetic alterations, and they're important because we have an action. We have a drug or treatment that can be applied in these particular biomarker-defined populations. And this is really where our field is moving to, in understanding how these biomarkers really help us to enrich and select for patients sensitive to these kinds of strategies. We also have biomarkers that we're using in a little bit more of a broader context. These are more kind of prognostic markers around how we're defining risk. And in localized prostate cancer, we do this routinely, and probably our best known one is prostate-specific antigen, PSA. It's a serum marker. Really, we think of PSA as a screen and everything, but originally PSA was discovered and developed as a biomarker of androgen receptor activity. This is turned on in prostate cancer, in normal prostate, under control of the androgen receptor. And as this level goes up, there's greater and greater androgen receptor activity present and more likelihood that's coming from cancer. And the higher it goes, the more likely those cells are actually extending into the bloodstream and out of the prostate and representing metastatic disease. There's a number of then genetic tests that we do on tissue, and of course Gleason score is how we characterize prostate cancer by its grade or grade group score. But in addition to that, there's Prolaris, there's Decipher. These are sort of multi-gene or genomic expression classifiers that also help us understand the activity within the cancer above and beyond that Gleason score. Artera AI is a multimodal AI test that includes digital pathology as well as other clinical and pathologic risk factors to predict who can benefit from or who is it unnecessary to use androgen deprivation therapy in the context of radiation. And then P10 immunohistochemistry. This has been around for a long time. There are several robust, clinically validated assays for use, and this is something that has been shown to have prognostic significance throughout the natural history of prostate cancer, from localized disease on through to metastatic disease. So what is P10, this phosphatase and tensin homolog protein? A name doesn't do it justice, but if you think back to our days of signal transduction biology, this plays really a critical role in how cytokines or growth factors kind of propagate their signal through cells to the nucleus to turn on protein synthesis and cell proliferation and survival. And that's shown here in this diagram, and I don't know if I've got a pointer or not, but I think maybe this works. There we go. Yeah. So we have these surface growth factor receptors, G-coupled proteins and receptor tyrosine kinases that activate PI3 kinase, and this is results in the phosphorylation of this phosphatidyl inositophosphates, either the bisphosphates, which are then converted into triphosphate, which activates this protein AKT, which is phosphorylated, turns on mTOR, and a number of protein signals. But there's one check in this signal, and that's this protein here, P10, that we're talking about. It's not an inhibitor. It's a phosphatase. What that means is it's reversing, this arrow's in the wrong direction, but this one is right. It's reversing the triphosphate back to a bisphosphate and turning off this signal to activate AKT. So you need a lot of P10 to turn this off and a little bit to turn on. So it needs to be at high levels. When it's deficient and at lower levels, then this tends to relatively turn on AKT. And when it's completely gone, then this is really constitutively activated. And that's really the signal here that we look for this sort of ongoing, unbridled growth signal that's occurring in parallel to androgen receptor biology. So P10 deficiency, as I mentioned, is something we can measure by immunohistochemistry. It's kind of all over the map. It's common. And it goes up over time from localized disease to what we're now terming metastatic androgen pathway modulating sensitivity, modulatory sensitivity, APMS or APMR resistance. And what you've shown here, I just took a sort of the average of a number of series of papers. This in localized disease ranging anywhere from maybe 15 to 25% in metastatic AP sensitive disease, we see it ranging anywhere from 25 to 40%. And in what used to be castrate resistant disease, now APMR, it's as high as 50%. So a very common biology that is being selected for as disease progresses. And that's really the important thing, both in terms of stage migration as well as disease state. We see higher and higher levels of this P10 deficiency, which suggests it's playing a role in that disease progression. And it's, as I said, it's also associated with poor prognosis. This is a meta-analysis that's sort of highlighting that poor prognosis, and a number of different studies that have all shown greater degrees of a poor outcome associated with that loss of P10 status or P10 deficiency. And you can see in this meta-analysis, lethal progression about a 2.5-fold greater likelihood of lethal disease, what we might consider castrate-resistant disease, associated with this. And then down on the bottom here, recurrence-free survival, about a 1.8 or 80% greater likelihood of disease progression. It's not just prostate cancer. We see loss of P10 in a number of solid tumors, and it's associated with poor prognosis. I mentioned several of these in prostate cancer and lung cancer. Again, activation of this PI3 AKT pathway through loss of P10 associated with a number of different features. We see it in breast cancer, gastric, colorectal. The only one that we didn't really see it in is ovarian, and that's probably because there are other ways of activating this pathway through mutation of AKT or PI3 kinase. So loss of P10 in prostate cancer, the most common but not the exclusive way of activating this pathway. And it's this dysregulation of the PI3-AKT pathway in prostate cancer that's predominantly caused by loss of P10. You can see here about a quarter, in this assessment, about a quarter of patients had activation of this pathway and 23% by loss of P10. But there's a smattering of other mechanisms here, PI3 kinase or AKT mutations that can activate independent of the phosphorylation of status of PIP3. In breast cancer, it's different. And interestingly, we actually see more activation of this pathway in breast cancer, and it's primarily driven by mutations in the PIK3CA gene, specifically 31%. There's a few AKT mutations. There's loss of P10 in just 6% in this case. So quite a bit different profile. But nonetheless, still constitutive activation of this pathway, however you slice it. And in prostate cancer, I said it's primarily due to P10. And it's gene deletions. It's loss of this gene that's really key. But there are other ways. You can get truncating mutations that essentially block the function of this gene. You can also get splicing variants. You can see missense, fusion, other genetic alterations. And on all of these, ultimately can result in loss of P10 protein expression. But there are some differences, some inconsistencies between P10 immunohistochemistry and genetic loss. And those are shown in this assay. So in the first column here, we have P10 that's intact. You can see this high brown staining. You can stain at high levels, at low levels. You know, this is perhaps a little overstained, but at the end of the day, all the cells are very highly present. And by FISH, we can see two copies of these red, it's hard to see here, but two red genes here in both. With homologous loss of P10, where there's no genetic expression, these cells are largely negative. Well, what I'll point out here in the arrow and the B are vascular cells, endothelial cells that still have P10 expression. They're not cancerous. They're normal vascular cells in the presence of the remaining prostate behind in the setting of this cancer cells. All the adenocarcinoma here is staining negative. And the same here, the adenocarcinoma is staining negative, but there's a trapped component of normal prostate over here that's staining positive. just to show you some of the challenges there. And then heterogeneous loss. So you've got loss of one copy of the gene, but not two. In this case, we're retaining the protein function. In this case, we're losing it. So it's just showing you why, you know, there can be some discordance between what we're seeing at a genetic level, perhaps, you know, some loss but not complete loss, and how it can be challenging to read some of these slides. Biologic implications of P10 loss deficiency here. I don't have time to go through all of these. There is an association with P10 in the ETS family gene. This is one of the most common translocations. It's also associated with poor prognosis in grade group 1 and 2 tumors, tumors that we might consider candidates for active surveillance. So looking at P10 status can have important connotations there. P10 and the AKT pathway do have some crosstalk, and it's important to recognize that these pathways are not completely parallel. There's interaction. And then P10 loss is also one of the first steps associated with the multi-genetic alterations leading to transdifferentiation to neuroendocrine or small cell prostate cancer, one of the most lethal forms of this disease. And that's just shown in this slide here, where we have the AKT pathway being activated. AKT blocking it and stuff. Okay,
sorry,
so
this might be your
I'm going to end here. That's
slide.
A neuroendocrine.
Yeah.
I'm just going to end here with the immunohistochemistry. I mentioned this earlier. This is less expensive, easier to do on tissue, requires less tissue. Next-gen sequencing gives us more information about other genetic alterations. I think of these as complementary, but this is really our standard approach. So I think just to summarize, P10 loss is common. It's associated with both stage and disease. This pathway leads to a parallel interactive signal for growth and proliferation. The alterations are commonly caused by loss of P10, and there's crosstalk. And ultimately, this biology can lead to a more AR variant and neuroendocrine phenotype. So thanks so much for your attention.
No, and thank you. And I just, you know, want to highlight just the complexities of this pathway.
Yeah.
It's probably quite new to many of us. We've heard P10, but there's a lot of questions. So we're going to move on to hear from our colleague, Niraj Agarwal, and his conversation with Dr. Love in just this topic alone. So we'll come back to some of those slides you didn't address, Dan, but okay. I'm pretty sure they're going to be important in the next set of questions. So go ahead and do the video.
Good evening, everyone. Doctors Agarwal and McKay recently met with me separately to present a series of queries and cases for our faculty, beginning with Dr. Agarwal, who rapidly recounted a series of provocative queries related to your presentation, Dan.
These are the questions for Dr. George, because according to his session, biology, testing, and clinical relevance. How early in prostate tumorigenesis does P10 loss occur? And do you view this primarily as an initiating event or a driver of disease progression? Clinically, how strong does P10 loss correlate with aggressive phenotype compared with other biomarkers such as BRCA2 or TP53? Should P10 deficiency be thought of as a prognostic marker or predictive marker or both? What is the real-world frequency of P10 loss in localized disease versus metastatic disease? How often do you see intra-patient heterogeneity when P10 status differs between the primary tumor and metastasis? In 2026, what is the most practical way to assess P10 loss in routine practice? Is it IHC, tumor NGS, or ctDNA testing? Should P10 testing be done at diagnosis of metastatic disease or only when considering targeted therapy? How does P10 loss influence your treatment thinking today, even before AKT inhibitors are fully integrated, assuming they are approved? Do you see P10 status becoming a standard biomarker like HRR mutation testing? Mechanistically speaking, why is P10 loss such a strong rationale for targeting the PI3-AKT-mTOR pathway? Do you think P10 deficient disease represent a distinct biological subtype that should be managed differently?
Okay, the good news for the audience is we're not going to tackle all of those 40 questions this evening. But I think that's just a semblance of what we're probably all thinking about this new path. How do we actually operationalize these things? So why don't we take a few of what Niraj has tossed our way, and maybe we'll take the first one. So, Dan, specifically here, how early in this prostate tumorigenesis do you think P10 loss occurs, as you mentioned in one of your slides? And do you think this is a primarily initiating event or as a driver?
And before maybe Dan answers,
please.
Niraj forgot one question, but yes. Dan will answer for sure.
Yeah.
Does God exist? But maybe come
yes,
back to
that's just
Peter.
All under and the subtext.
Yes, okay. Yes, okay. Yes, okay. Yes, yes,
no, absolutely.
Yeah, it's a lot to unpack there. But let's start at the beginning, because I think it's a really important point.
Yeah.
Because P10 loss is something we see really early on. I mentioned in this Gleason 1 cancer, grade group 1 cancer, we can see loss of P10. It's probably not the initiating event. It's probably one of the events that's associated with the progression of this disease, and that's what we see throughout the course of this natural history of prostate cancer, that loss of P10 is associated with a more rapid growth and transition, whether it be by grade, by stage, and ultimately by disease state. So I think of it as being associated more with progressive disease. It's really difficult to determine, you know, carcinogenesis mm-hmm. in this case, but I think primarily that's driven through androgen mm-hmm. receptor biology in the vast mm-hmm. majority of cases.
No, I think that's really great. Maybe sort of the third question here is, I think you mentioned this in one of your slides, just so it's ingrained in our minds, it's just what's the frequency of this P10 deficiency, you know, in localized versus metastatic disease?
Yeah,
we're certainly
I kind of showed
used to
some
that.
Of that. Yeah, mm-hmm. I showed some of that. So
yes, you did.
It's nuanced because it depends on what level of P10 deficiency you're going to use. You know, Kareem's going to show you a study where we used a 90% threshold cutoff for loss of P10. If you lowered that to 50%, you'd see a higher level. So that's why I think the literature is highly variable in this aspect. But the truth is that, you know, this is happening even at relatively low levels or heterogeneous loss of P10 gene expression, probably in many more prostate cancers than we're recognizing. To what extent that sort of partial loss is biologically active, we don't know. But as I said, as a phosphatase, the relatively lower levels of this are going to lead to a relative shift of activity. It's really the more complete loss that really turns that pathway on constitutively. And it's why, you know, we focused in clinical trials on the very high deficiency of this, why that matters most.
Yeah. Well, and I think the concept of testing, as you mentioned, whether it's molecular testing, immunohistochemistry, we as practicing clinicians want to know what's the optimal method to assess P10 status. Yeah. When should this testing be done? Should it become relevant when this path either moves forward or doesn't? But I think the audience wants to know that as well.
Yeah,
as Niraj.
Yeah. I'll tell you that, you know, what's been tried and true and studied for a long time is immunohistochemistry. There's also FISH, and I showed one slide with some of that where we can kind of look at the nuclear chromosomal level of that gene mm-hmm. present, but probably, you know, what's newest is genetic testing or next-gen sequencing of mm-hmm. multi-gene tools like we see with, like, Foundation or Caris or Tempus. So to me, I think recognizing these as different modalities of assessing P10, but immunohistochemistry been around the longest, is the direct measure of the protein. That's the activating form. That's what's probably most important. It's something that can be done on the least amount of tissue. So even these small biopsies where we're getting a millimeter or so of cancer sometimes, we can pick that up in. And it's also something that I think at the end of the day is scalable and affordable. It can be done in a day versus, you know, being able to send these blocks off, waiting for pathology to ship it somewhere and get those results back. So it's not to say that next-gen sequencing isn't important. When we do see genetic loss, that's going to translate into the immunohistochemistry. It's about 90% concordance that way. When we see differences in immunohistochemistry, it's not always shown up in the genetic loss because there are other ways of knocking out the gene. So there is a little bit of discordance. But for the most part, this high level of P10 loss in immunohistochemistry is going to correlate with the genetic loss that we see on next-gen sequencing.
When do you think that testing should be done, though? You
know? So personally, I think there's value in it in any level of prostate cancer, but probably going to be most important in these high-risk or metastatic cases. So to me, when I have somebody with a metastatic prostate cancer, this is something we want to know, because I think we're beginning to appreciate, and the study that Kareem's going to show us, Capitella 281, really drives home prospectively for the first time what this biology of, you know, PTEN deficiency looks like in a large prospective trial with and without targeted therapy for it.
Well, lest the audience think there's no more questions, let us then switch to Raina McKay's questions. So she's got a handful as well in her conversation with Dr. Love.
Dr. McKay formulated her queries for the faculty related to cases from her practice, beginning with a 69-year-old man with hormone-sensitive recurrent metastatic disease after primary radiation therapy previously.
He was found to have PTEN loss, homozygous deletion, on the NGS testing on his archival primary tissue specimen from back in 2017 from his biopsy near diagnosis. At the time that he actually was diagnosed with metastatic disease, his PSA was only 10 and testosterone was 357 when imaging demonstrated multiple bony lesions, the rib, left scapula, T1, L3, sacrum, and also adenopathy, and he also had retroperitoneal and like a left supraclav node. I think this kind of speaks to the discordance a little bit of PSA with PTEN loss.
And I'm just kind of curious, let's say you could access capivasertib. Do you think he would be inclined to be one to treat it or not?
You know, it's a possibility. I think individuals that are a throw the kitchen sink at me doc type people are generally individuals that I think are well-suited for escalated therapy, and escalated therapy that comes at a cost. This individual is incredibly high-functioning. The leuprolide and abiraterone that he's on do not really negatively impact his ability to do his activities of daily living. He works as an executive. If this individual presented today like this, and we actually had capivasertib that was approved and available for us to potentially use, I would absolutely discuss the treatment options and go through the pros and cons. And I would propose to the faculty, what would you do in this scenario?
Right at you, Dan. What would you do in this scenario?
So we're going to see this data in a little bit. Mm-hmm. And I think what you're going to see is that this is a poor prognostic patient. Even though he's tolerating the hormonal therapy well, even though his PSA is responding, I'm concerned that PSA is not enough in these circumstances. That these are the patients, he already had a low PSA to begin with. These are the patients that are at high risk for developing disease progression independent of a PSA rise. Not to say the PSA is completely zero, maybe low, but it's not rapidly rising as the first sign of castration resistance. And that's what we typically see when we're using, you know, these androgen receptor pathway inhibitors in ADT. And what we see differently in the Capitello 281 study is this discordance. And I think it's an indication of this AKT pathway. Because again, this isn't activating the PSA gene the way androgen receptor does. So with growth and proliferation driven through the PI3 kinase AKT pathway, we would expect disease progression without necessarily a significant rise in PSA, and we see that. So I'm concerned, even though this patient's responding, he's tolerating his abiraterone well, he's a good candidate to treat with capivasertib. Mm-hmm. And I would absolutely want to talk to him and discuss that option with him.
I wonder, Kareem, have you encountered patients with aggressive disease that ended up being from PTEN deficiency? You know, kind of seeing that low PSA. I think we all know to look for that when you have an imbalance of the imaging versus what the PSA is. Have you seen that in your practice?
Yes, obviously, yes. And not to say that all patients with PTEN deficiency don't have high PSA, for example, baseline. If they have de novo metastatic disease, they might, actually. It's more during the course of a disease that, indeed, as Dan just said, when they tend to progress with their cancer growing, the PSA either will remain low or sometimes even zero. Mm-hmm. So that exists. It's not necessarily only PTEN deficiency cancers. We also see this phenomenon when neuroendocrine differentiation occurs. Mm-hmm. But clearly, this is a phenomenon we saw more frequently in the trial, for example, in this population of patients with PTEN deficiency. Again, not saying that there is no rise at all in the PSA, but it's not necessarily reaching the classical 25% increase and greater than 2 nanograms per ml. It's again, slower and milder, I guess.
Yeah, it's a little different pattern of recognition. I think that's something that we may have to get used to in the future. You know, Reina's other question is, I guess we'll start with you, Kareem. If the drug was available, is that an appropriate option on the basis of NGS testing, or is that good enough on archival tissue? Would you have to do a metastatic biopsy? And especially you're not in the U.S. in practice, what would you think about that from an international standpoint?
Sure. Now, those are important considerations with regards to, well, many things, cost, but also patient convenience, for example, if you need to rebiopsy. It appears that archival tissue is mostly informative. So that's important. And same for BRCA alterations, for example. And I would say the exact opposite when it comes to androgen receptor mutations, which typically occur under therapeutic pressure. So here, again, if your patient was diagnosed, say, 3 years ago, he had a local treatment and then he relapsed with metastatic disease, you can mostly trust the archival biopsies or prostatectomy specimen, which makes all her life easier. Now, in some cases, simply the archival tissue is not any longer useful just because it was harvested a long time ago, and so you cannot use it any longer. So that's very important to know. Now, between the discussion also between immunohistochemistry and NGS, I mean, I think was very clear about it. Mm-hmm. If you set the cutoff quite high with the immunohistochemistry, you're covering most of the NGS information. So greater than 90%, which we use in the trial, didn't come from nowhere. We had internal data, but also external data, supporting quite a great correlation between this cutoff and the NGS findings. And when we set the trial, we actually discussed whether we should go for one or the other. Mm-hmm. Immunohistochemistry is much easier, of course, and much cheaper. So if successful, it can be used in many places worldwide, to address your question, while NGS remains quite expensive at many places.
Yeah. And I think in terms of the bigger picture, as we think about what is the appropriate test to get us there, we are going to now hear from you on how do you target AKT really in this setting? Because conceptually, as outlined by Dan, beautiful sort of signaling and so on, but what's it really mean and what other stuff is in play in this space? So please
sure.
Take it away.
Happy to do so. You may have a question. I wonder whether we can take questions or whether this should be sent by using your phone.
Yes, I think there... Well, can we just have them answer that, or would you prefer that she write it down? Sorry.
Right.
We want to make sure we're responsive, and we appreciate your engagement in this because it is a new topic, and it's going to take a lot of conversations like these to really be prepared to expand our menu for patients. So I think it's a big thing. So if you could write it down, it might be helpful as we're cull that information, and then go ahead, Kareem. You can get started, and then we'll take our questions after.
Sure.
So thank you so much.
Thank you, Elizabeth. So let me dig into the clinical data with regards to AKT targeting in metastatic prostate cancer, both in the hormone-sensitive space and the castration-resistant space. So Dan already alluded to that, just to remind you that basically What we think is that there is a quite strong crosstalk between the AR pathway and the AKT-P10 pathway, meaning that every time you would hit one of these pathways, we will activate the other one. And of course, the conclusion from that is that ideally you should target both pathways at the same time. So that's what the lab was telling us when first generation AKT inhibitors were developed in this disease. And actually, I like this first randomized phase 2 trial, which was designed years ago, with abiraterone being combined or not with ipatasertib, another AKT inhibitor. I think this was a quite elegant proof of concept trial. And as you can see, to the right-hand side, and maybe I will show you that. Okay. For patients without PTEN deficiency, you don't see much benefit from the combination of the two drugs, while for patients with PTEN loss, you see a marked difference favoring the combination of abiraterone alone. And actually what was reported with 400 milligram dose of ipatasertib was also supported by data at 200 milligrams. Again, PTEN intact, no benefit. PTEN loss, clear benefit. So this was really a first, and this clearly stimulate going further. A phase 3 trial was then designed and conducted. And actually, as you can see, you can take the data both ways. On the one hand, it's a positive phase 3 trial. Radiographic progression-free survival was significantly improved in patients with PTEN deficiency. And for the sake of time, I won't show you there was another group of patients without PTEN deficiency and there was no benefit. So again, supporting what I just showed you. But it really comes back to the biomarker discussion we just had. It's maybe too small to see on the screen, but you will see again that patients with PTEN deficiency benefit, not those without PTEN deficiency. But when it comes to PTEN by next generation sequencing, it makes a bigger difference with patients with PTEN loss, complete PTEN loss, clearly benefited, while patients without that did not really benefit. So again, the immunohistochemistry and the NGS do not completely cover the same information, and it's really a question of cutoff. Which, of course, makes the whole story tricky, but we are learning, obviously. This is actually in bigger now. Data from the same trial with radiographic progression-free survival for patients with PTEN loss by sequencing. And as you can see, curves separate more as compared to what I just showed when the immunohistochemistry was used. Now, this first data was shown some years ago, about a year ago or a year and a half ago. We saw updated analysis with more mature data for overall survival. And unfortunately, overall survival was not improved by ipatasertib in this particular trial. And as you can see, if PTEN loss was assessed by immunohistochemistry, really there was no benefit at all. While with the NGS, the curves tend to separate, favoring again the combination arm, even though the statistically significance was not reached, but that was not far. So this was the first in castration-resistant disease. And then pretty much at this time, when we were waiting actually from the phase 3, the very first analysis from the phase 3, we were discussing whether we should go for another trial with another compound, capivasertib, which is kind of different as compared to ipatasertib, but this time in earlier stages in patients with metastatic hormone-sensitive disease. So this is really the design of the trial, which is called Capitello 281. As Dan already alluded to, we decided to go for immunohistochemistry. We use a cutoff of greater than 90% of viable malignant cells with no specific staining in the cytoplasm. And of course, this patient had a metastatic hormone-sensitive disease de novo. All these patients were diagnosed with their metastatic dissemination at the same time they were diagnosed with a prostate cancer. This was an enormous effort to screen patients. More than 6,000 men were actually screened worldwide to detect approximately 25% of them with PTEN deficiency using this definition. Stratification was based on disease extent and geography, and they were randomized to receive 1,000 plus patients were randomized in a one-to-one fashion to receive either abiraterone prednisone using classical regimen or the same plus capivarsotib given twice a day. It can be done with or without food. The PK is quite neat. 4 days on, 3 days off to try to make patients comfortable with the side effects of a drug. Primary endpoint was investigators assessed radiographic progression for survival, and there were, as often, many secondary endpoints, including overall survival. So this is the primary endpoint, and again, this is a positive phase 3 trial. Radiographic progression-free survival is significantly improved. This was shown earlier today, or yesterday, actually, by Dan at the oral session of the Congress. We saw about a 20% reduction in the risk of progression, progressive disease or death. And as you can see, the median time to RPFS in the control arm was quite short, approximately 2 years, which is shorter as compared to what you would expect for a more general population of men receiving ADT and abiraterone, again showing us how bad cancers are those with PTEN deficiencies. This was improved up to approximately 33 months with an absolute difference of 7.5 months. So, very importantly, I think in this trial is the analysis based on the cutoff we used, but also exploratory cutoff for PTEN deficiency. So again, this is the cutoff of greater than 90% that I just showed you. But now, if you look at the efficacy of the capivarsotib arm using different cutoffs, greater than 90%, greater than 95%, greater than 99%, and 100% PTEN loss, you see that the drug works pretty much the same. But it's not the same story in the control arm. Now this is, again, greater than 90%, greater than 95%, getting worse, 99%, even worse, and now 100%, even worse. So the more the PTEN loss, the worse the disease, at least the worse the natural history of the disease, but you see that the effect of the drug remains, whatever the importance of the magnitude of a loss in PTEN, which is biologically very important. Overall survival is obviously not mature. As you can see by the Kaplan-Meier curves, most men were alive when we did the analysis. The medians were not reached even in the control arm. We see a 10% reduction, not significant at this time, and time will tell. Probably in about a year from now, we will be able to have more mature data. This came together with at least a trend in terms of time to symptomatic skirted event or symptomatic skirted event-free survival, should I say. 47 months in median, it was reached, versus 42 months. Again, a clinical important difference. Patients clearly don't like to have a bone fracture or another SSC. The phenomenon that I just showed you regarding the magnitude of efficacy of a drug for RPFS was also shown or suggested with overall survival. And you can see using a cutoff for 100%, that the curves really separate nicely. Even if I as I just said it, the data are not mature as we're speaking. So in conclusion, this is really the first phase 3 trial in patients with metastatic hormone-sensitive disease and PTEN deficiency. It clearly confirms our initial feeling that these patients have a poor outcome and poorer as compared to de novo metastatic disease. The primary endpoint of RPFS was significantly met, and the secondary endpoint trends towards the same direction as you just saw. Overall survival is immature. We need to be patient. And there is greater efficacy with greater PTEN deficiency. I think we'll speak about side effects later on, but really the two main side effects in the trial were rash and hypoglycemia, which is on target, and this was clearly expected. And I think this was my last slide. Thank you.
Thank you for that, and lots of really great information. You too will get questions from our friend Niraj Agarwal in his conversation with Dr. Love.
Dr. Agarwal also teed up some great questions related to the focus of the second module.
Now I have questions for Dr. Karim Fizazi. Looking back at iPotential 150 trial, what was the key signal that convinced the field that AKT inhibition is biologically meaningful? What were the main reasons that ipatasertib program did not move forward despite positive signals in subsets of these patients? How do you think about the pharmacologic differences between ipatasertib and capivasertib? Should we now be routinely testing PTEN at the time of MHSPC diagnosis to identify candidates with high degree of PTEN loss? How would you prioritize triplet therapy with docetaxel versus triplet therapy with ARPI plus AKT inhibitor? Where do you see AKT inhibitor story going next? Earlier in the disease, combination strategies, or biomarker refinement? Beyond PTEN loss, are there other genomic signatures that may predict benefit to capivasertib?
Do you see yourself using capivasertib if it becomes available to treat prostate cancer?
If you look at 100% PTEN loss, the data are quite compelling. 22 months with ADT plus ARPI and 34 months with ADT plus ARPI plus capivasertib. That is an year added to our patients' lives without experiencing progression with a disease phenotype which is highly aggressive. And I think that's meaningful to me, yeah. I will use it, yeah. I think many of these patients experience disease progression in a rapid fashion that they are not able to maintain their performance status, or they are not able to maintain their desire or will to fight with cancer when they experience these severe symptoms with disease progression.
Wow, that's a lot of questions. So we have counted on Niraj to deliver just that. I want to remind folks in the audience and online, if you do have questions, use the QR code so that we can make sure we try to get to them. Before we get to Niraj's question, we do have a question from the audience. It's actually really insightful. What do you think in terms of the use of mTOR inhibitors in PTEN loss prostate cancer, Karim?
We had several trials looking at mTOR inhibitors, either in selected populations or not, and the signal was weaker. Let's put it like this. It was not nothing. Some patients appeared to benefit, but again, in a weaker fashion. Mm-hmm. So this is why it was not pursued. At least for most of them. But I think some companies are still considering this. Mm-hmm.
Certainly a compound we're familiar with. Now, it's a tough question. Why did ipatasertib not move forward? Was there some major reason that this audience needs to know? Were there actual pharmacologic differences between the two agents? What do you think?
Yeah, I think, you know, the you know, the EPA program was probably stopped in prostate cancer just because the magnitude of the benefit was smaller as compared to what I just showed in the randomized phase 2 trial. Mm-hmm. And it didn't really come with other benefit to patients. Overall survival was negative, and again, there was no quality, time to deterioration in quality of life, time to pain deterioration, or time to SSEs. You know, endpoints that would convince you, probably, and probably also the agencies, to approve a drug and to use it in our practice. Mm-hmm. So this is why the patasertib program failed, I think. Mm-hmm. Now, Neeraj was asking me what was the rationale from moving from EPA to CAPI. I think I would say the consistency of the data that we saw in CRPC was a real good signal. Again, randomized phase 2 trial, 200 milligram dosing, 400 milligram dosing, same findings. PTEN loss benefit, no PTEN loss, no benefit. Mm-hmm. And then phase 3 trial, even if the magnitude of the benefit was smaller, the same trend, let's say, was supported. So with a different drug, potentially more active, there was clear rationale that we should try it also, and maybe earlier when the disease is easier, hopefully, to target. And this is why we chose metastatic hormone-sensitive disease.
Yeah. Well, and Dan, I might ask you, you know, just in terms of if this actually was going to go to the clinic, how are you going to make a choice? We now have an abundance of riches of doublets and triplets and emerging other lutetium and PARPs. What do you think?
Yeah, I think that's going to be a really important question. But, you know, all of these are a relative subset. So when you're looking at sort of 25% of patients that have this 90% or greater loss of P10, the number of those patients that are going to have a BRCA mutation or MSI high, probably going to be really low. So I don't think we're going to see, like, overlap of these targetable, actionable, approaches too often. But there are other less you know, biologically defined approaches like docetaxel chemotherapy or potentially radioligand therapy that could be applied to these populations. Mm-hmm. The truth is that we don't have prospective data with those approaches in this population. I think the most important thing to recognize is that this study, Capitello 281, defined a new biologic subpopulation of prostate cancer, P10 deficiency. It has poor prognosis, and it has a different pattern of spread of complications, a higher, more symptomatic bone complication rate, a relatively low PSA at progression, and probably a higher rate of visceral progression. So it makes sense to me, based on the biology of AKT and this first step in developing differentiation towards neuroendocrine disease, to say that's what we really want to prohibit. Whatever side effects you show, the disease that's associated with this biology is worse. Yeah. So using a very specific targeted agent to disrupt that pathway early, before other alterations happen, probably the best strategy we have. Other strategies like radioligands and chemotherapy we use throughout the natural history of this advanced metastatic disease, this is really targeted specifically for this population.
Mm-hmm. Well, Kareem, we have a great audience question on this discordance that you mentioned in terms of P10 and PSA. So the audience member wants to know, does that mean we should do imaging in a different way in spite of no rise in PSA? Thoughts?
Yeah, actually, this is a key question. I fully agree. We will do more effort in the trial to tease out how many patients actually progressed with zero PSA rises versus how many of them progressed with some rises which did not reach the 25% threshold. And I think this is really key. Because if ever most patients actually develop a rise in PSA, even modest, then perhaps we can keep using PSA only for those of us who do that, on top, of course, of clinical assessments in all the patients with metastatic hormone-sensitive disease and PTEN loss. Yeah. Because, and knowing that we will need to react even if the PSA is just rising.
Yeah.
Now, if many patients actually experience a cancer progression with a zero PSA rise, then you're very right. Mm-hmm. We will, or this person is very right. We will need to change all the pattern of surveillance and integrate, at least for these patients with PTEN loss, systematically some kinds of imaging. So so hopefully we will be able to dig into those details this year. We have an agreement with a company to do so. And clinically, it's very important, I think.
Well, I think that's, again, from an audience, what am I doing Monday morning in my own clinic if this was available? Those are the questions that would make us know what to do next.
Absolutely.
Raina McKay is in another conversation with Dr. Love, and let's see what her questions are.
Dr. McKay's next case is a common vexing clinical scenario, a patient with hormone-sensitive metastatic disease with a suboptimal response to triplet therapy.
67-year-old gentleman presenting with de novo metastatic disease, had a PSA on routine screening. He wasn't having symptoms, PSA of 115. MRI shows that he's got a tumor in his prostate, 2.5 centimeter Pyrex 5 tumor with extension out of the capsule, and also osseous metastases within the left femoral neck and the pelvic region. He had a biopsy, 4 plus 3 cancer, 10 out of 14 cores were sampled, but he didn't have 8, 9, 10 disease. He did have a PTEN loss on NGS testing, ended up ultimately getting relegolix darolutamide plus chemotherapy. And his PSA declined. He was at like 129, 67, 35, 2, and 1. And, you know, he definitely was not in the group that hit that nadir PSA of 0.2 within 6 months. And even a year out or a year and a half out from him starting his therapy, his PSA was still 1.03. And so I think this kind of was a case around the question of radiographic progression on an RP despite a declining PSA. And I'm like worried about this guy. I'm scanning this guy every 3 to 4 months. I'm just worried of disease progression for him. This question comes up so many times with patients as well, that it's like, why are you waiting for me to progress? Like, why don't you just give me something to, you know, prevent me from progressing? And I get it. I hear it. And a part of me does. It's like, I'm worried that he's going to progress and potentially progress in a bad way. And so what would you do? There is a trial called the triple switch study that's being conducted through the cooperative groups. And if they don't hit a PSA of less than 0.2, actually layering in docetaxel, he got triple therapy. So it's like, what are you going to escalate him with? This is a guy who, if I could add capivasertib right now, I would add it. I'm just worried about him.
Don't we all have those kinds of similar scenarios? You know, I think in general, again, it comes back to you have a lot of options now for MHSPC. One of the questions is, you know, if you were going to just think in terms of side effects and whatnot, Kareem, just is this a conversation with triplet instead of doublet versus, you know, a new agent like Capi? How would you strategize this? And is PTEN loss the only thing you're going to use to make this decision? Because Raina needs some other signals, and I think many of us do as well.
Sure. And actually, I fully agree with what Raina said. Well, number one, there are good reason to believe that these patients with PTEN loss may actually benefit from the docetaxel chemotherapy. Mm-hmm. Retrospective data, but coming from prospective trial, still need confirmation. But actually, outside the trial, and if capivasertib is not available, if I know that the patient has a PTEN loss, like she did, I would go for a triplet and not a doublet. So that's one thing. Second, we know crystal clear that PSA value at 6 to 8 months, say, is a strong prognostic factor. So it's very informative. And what we're targeting classically is below 0.2, but actually probably what we should target is zero. Mm-hmm. And there probably remains still some room between zero and 0.2 in terms of prognosis. So yes, in a patient who is a poor responder, you'd like to do something. She just explained the ongoing trial in the U.S. adding docetaxel or randomly, but this patient had it already. We actually have a trial in France and in Europe randomizing lutetium PSMA in this particular setting of poor responders, whatever the patient has received before, doublet or triplet. It seems that PSMA is actually expressed often in these poor responders. But whatever the drug and the concept we're randomizing, it's an opportunity for research. That's crystal clear. Unfortunately, we did not start earlier. I think that's part of my regret now, because we know that for a long time. It's also because now we have the weapons available to test those strategies. Yeah. So, coming back to Raina's patients, I think she does a perfect job. She did her best with the available treatments, providing a triplet, and now she's anxious about a progression. She's monitoring very closely his patients so that she may be able to intervene as soon as possible when eventually we'll progress, which will likely, unfortunately, happen sooner than later.
I think many of us have those patients that we're just anxious about. You're waiting for the shoe to drop. Now, the other thing, and we'll end with her session on, or question on, well, we do a lot of things in the CRPC state as well as CSPC, not using the right terminology, Dan, many apologies. But the big question is, Dan, if you had this agent, would you throw it in an MCRPC setting and P10 loss?
You know, it's a great question. You did see that there is, you know, data from a similar agent showing activity in that setting. So I wouldn't say like there's no evidence to do that. Mm-hmm. It's not level one evidence for capivasertib. Mm-hmm. Our preference is to use it early because I think that's where the biology is more likely dependent on strictly the AKT pathway versus in castrate-resistant disease are going to be other alterations and whatnot.
Yep.
That all said, you know, the old adage, better late than never. I mean, in somebody like this, if there, you know, isn't clear small cell carcinoma, if it's this AR variant, if there's this, you know, high loss of P10, and we've used other life-prolonging agents already in that population, it's not unreasonable to consider this.
Yeah.
But, you know, I would probably treat, once they get into the castrate-resistant setting, you know, with more of the proven life-extending therapies like lutetium, you know, 177, or docetaxel chemotherapy, cabazitaxel chemotherapy, before using this kind of off that label. So to me, the real compelling thing is to use this early, right? The other agents have proven to benefit throughout, even in this castrate-resistant setting. This is really identified to be beneficial specifically in metastatic hormone sensitive. So when I see loss of P10 there, I'm, you know, my goal is to use it because I want to use everything and I can't really use this later into the same level of evidence that using it earlier, you know, has.
I think a lot of the things that we do in our decision making though is sort of how does this make the patient feel? We've talked a lot about biomarkers, what's the actual data, how does it compare to others. But then comes the practicality that we're going to talk about here in the third module about what are actually the side effects that were experienced. You did a great discussion about this earlier in this meeting, Dan. And I think you can see from the audience just in terms of adverse events. You know, there's a very familiar slide that many of us who are maybe more anxious about how your patients are going to feel right after you get the shiny part over with where, wow, it's a new way, it's a new drug. Then you go, well, how are my folks going to feel? I think here you can just see in general how capivasertib plus abi versus placebo plus abi is stating. And, you know, just looking at sort of any AE grade 3, it is a little bit higher in the combination versus abi alone. But it is also, from a profile standpoint, consistent with just irrespective of what your PTEN deficiency cutoff is. So it's really quite an interesting safety summary slide. When you're looking at the adverse events, I look at things that would really bother my patients. And in here, looking at this sort of in descending order, you have diarrhea. And we'll talk about that a little bit more, but that is something that we're going to hear about from our patients. Hypoglycemia. So this does impact the glucose, and then rash, as Kareem had mentioned, and then all of the other sort of familiar ones. So it isn't a drug that is without any side effects, but I think being very thoughtful and intentional about our approach is usually how we can gain some, not just experience, but confidence in being able to use a new agent like this. I really appreciated the discussion that Dan had earlier in this meeting about how do actually people feel. And here, this is not hearsay. You actually have FACT-FEE physical well-being scores. And these are things that really affect our patients, like what's your energy level? How's your nausea? How's your pain? And I think in doing that, we can see that the line is basically right on top of each other. I think that gives us some comfort there. Again, looking at other measures such as ability to work, sleep quality, ability to enjoy life. These are really meaningful endpoints for patients who are still living with this disease. And again, the curves are really superimposable. And just looking at that, I think makes us feel that we're not harming the patient in a way that to get the benefit that was mentioned earlier comes at a great cost. And looking at the FACT-P total score, again, this is now a more global physical, functional, emotional well-being, other prostate cancer-related symptoms, again, superimposable. So as a practicing clinician, I appreciate these slides very much because we want to make sure that patients can really do well. This slide is also really important. Just how do you do once you have an adverse event? You know, what are these discontinuations? And it occurred early. So in a way, majority of this discontinuation in 63% of patients occurred in the first 3 months. So that also is a lesson for us to get a hold of this, to be prepared so that you're not taken off guard. And I think we probably in real practice, if this goes forward, could be a lot more ready from a care team perspective, from your MDT, from your regular team that you work with in terms of how to manage that. And these are sort of the common AEs that were available. But I think the big question here when we look at this is sort of what were the top three? And we're going to do just a deeper dive on those of diarrhea, rash, and hyperglycemia. But to know that it happened early and they were manageable. So if we go into what are actually the events, and sometimes I forget the CTC AE grading myself. So if you look at it from 1 to 4, you know, from a patient level, less than 4 stools is a grade 1. But from a patient level, a grade 2 is not fun either, right? If you're spending your time 4 to 6 times where you're in the bathroom a day, even though that's a grade 2, I think it's important to know that that's not nothing. Many of our studies have always focused on, well, if you have a grade 3, then we're going to do something about that. And I think lessons learned over time have showed that we're actually going to be quite proactive. So if you're looking at just grade 2, holding the drug so that you have recovery to less than 4 stools a day, then there are some guidelines where if you get recovered within, you know, say less than 28 days, you can resume the same dose, but you can also dose reduce in the interest of your patient. I think here, if it's grade 4, makes sense, you would permanently discontinue. I think one of the things that sort of pops up that, you know, from a patient level, diarrhea, we're all going to hear about it, but hyperglycemia is not a unique topic. This is an issue for a lot of compounds, but I think in AKT inhibition particularly that there is a mechanism that you can get hyperglycemia as evidenced by this sort of disruption of the difference between gluconeogenesis versus sort of storage, insulin sensitivity, and whatnot. But at the root of it, it's a way to figure out how do you manage this. And many of our patients with prostate cancer have some form of hyperglycemia, diabetes, type 2 diabetes. Some are diet controlled. Some are much more aggressively treated with insulin. And I think here, these are really practical guidelines. But if we know that hyperglycemia is going to occur, we will be prepared, know what to do. Same thing. You're over 161, for example. You're going to withhold until you gain control. Now, I think what's important here is that this was an actual bullet point of eligibility in this trial, meaning folks that had, in a way, uncontrolled diabetes or requiring insulin or having a hemoglobin A1C of 8 were sort of really not enrolled. So you're having a different patient population, but when you're in the real world, these are our patients. They are walking around with worse numbers. So being very prepared and knowing how to handle this is important. So practical things could be, before we start this with this agent, test your fasting glucose levels. What is your hemoglobin A1C? Optimize that process. That might mean medication. That might mean weight loss, maybe with a fancy inhibitor, lots of strategies. And then once you start, you can monitor your fasting glucose on day 3 or 4 of the dosing. Again, it's not continuous dosing on capivasertib, and then checking it often and then on monthly, and then monitoring your hemoglobin A1C. I think this approach is very practical for us because you can implement this to say, we're going to follow this and know what to do with it in terms of dose reductions. With regards to rash, just as a reminder, again, the minute you hit grade 2, those macular papules and basically red skin that pops up and patients are saying, what are you going to do about this? We grade it based on just availability of that rash in the patient. So 10 to 30% is already a grade 2. You don't need to have greater than 30% to know that you need to do a dose reduction. It's the same thing, aggressive, often early evaluation, withhold the drug until you have recovery. And I think that's the messaging for a lot of these compounds. And then fatigue is another one that was also on the list, where grade 2, as a reminder, that means fatigue, not relieved by rest, already limiting instrumental ADLs. Again, withhold. So I think there's a trend that we're seeing here. You don't wait till grade 3. You don't wait till your patient's in trouble, because when you're going to run into trouble, it's right there within the first 3 months. So in general, if you just sort of take those kinds of grading guidelines, I think it's just easier to be able to share that information with the patient as well, because you'll be relying on that patient to co-manage these issues. So with all of this, I also get questions from our friend Niraj Agarwal in his discussion with Dr. Love. So let's hear it.
Dr. Agarwal's third set of rapid-fire queries focused on the issue of tolerability of capivasertib.
Now I have questions for Dr. Elizabeth Heath, mostly about tolerability and real-world management of capivasertib. From a clinician's perspective, what is the single most common toxicity that affects adherence to capivasertib? How aggressive should clinicians be in prophylaxis and early intervention for diarrhea? At what point do you hold versus dose reduce versus discontinue capivasertib for diarrhea? As far as metabolic side effects are concerned, hyperglycemia is the one which stands out. Should we be screening all patients with baseline hemoglobin A1C before considering treating them with capivasertib? Are endocrinology referrals commonly needed in practice for these patients? How significant are cutaneous events? And do they resemble what we see with other targeted therapies? Are topical interventions meaningful in preventing dose interruptions with capivasertib when they have skin toxicities? Are there patient population where you would hesitate to use capivasertib, such as those with diabetes, especially those with uncontrolled diabetes, frailty, or older age? What is the learning curve clinicians should expect in the first year of using this regimen? Our medical oncology colleagues are using AKT inhibition strategies, including capivasertib, in other cancer types. I think the challenge will be with the urology practices. And I expect there will be some learning curve. There is a learning curve for all new drugs, whether it is capivasertib or any drug, for example, lutetium, PARP inhibitors. We regularly see that side effects are usually higher in the clinical trials.
Good news. I got the same number of questions as the other two, because Niraj is, I think, the best patient advocate of all to make sure that we're not doing anything to harm the patients. And I think a lot of his questions is exactly what we chatted about. Now, if you say, what is the most common toxicity? I mean, I'm going to answer that from what the patient would really complain about, and that's diarrhea. And I'll ask you, Dan, you know, in what setting would you say, if somebody already has sort of not great bowels, that you would say this is a non-starter, or would you just aggressively address that so they would have a shot at this medication?
Yeah, you know, I think the thing to recognize is we're dealing with an accelerated disease course. This cancer is going to cause symptoms sooner rather than later. So it's worth trying in these patients that have loss of P10 to see if they can tolerate it. But in someone that's already having, say, irritable bowel or GI symptoms, this is where I might be, you know, leaning towards adding Imodium a little bit sooner rather than later, loperamide, and maybe even prophylactic. The onset of diarrhea is within 12 days, so this is pretty quick. And remember, this is 4 days on, 3 days off. So you're not taking constant, you know, loperamide. You might take it for those first 4 days, take a break. And then, you know, if they're not having bowel movements, we're going to wait until they go. But be able to kind of stay on top of that and manage that appropriately. Mm-hmm. We're taking breaks anyway, but you could stop early, you know, if they're having a lot of diarrhea. And, you know, we don't want to overshoot and end up with constipation. That can be just as uncomfortable. So
So
just recognizing this, working with the patients, but recognizing up front this is going to happen within the first couple of weeks of treatment.
Yeah. I think the big question as well is sort of how do you manage sugars? And we're in such a state for even folks who are on abiraterone and prednisone, right? So we are in a menopausal state where you have metabolic syndrome already on board. So, you know, his question, I guess, to all of us is, how aggressive do we want to be? My answer is very aggressive, because if you're not having control right off the bat or have an implementation plan to monitor, you're already behind, in my opinion. I think the endocrinology referral depends on where you practice. If you feel comfortable managing sugars, of which many of us have to, because endocrinology is usually not available immediately. So you're going to have to take some intervention. But I wonder, Kareem, from the outside of the U.S., you know, are you going to subspecialize referral to endocrinology, et cetera?
I would provide the very same answer. I mean, outside the U.S. is obviously broad, so I cannot answer for every country. But it's true that at least in many places I know, and in many countries, you would not have an endocrinologist of a label like this if you have a sugar glycemia issue with your patient. Mm-hmm. So you need to learn how to deal with that. We were trained to do that in internal medicine in France, and honestly, we do that.
Yeah.
We tend to refer patients that are really hard to treat, but not, you know, primary treatment, very very clearly. So and this was the case in the trial. You may also do this with a GP, depending on whether GPs are available, yes or no, and that also that varies very clearly according to countries. But I think that those are things you first need to, as you rightly said, to monitor, because otherwise you never know, and then to handle quite aggressively with drugs, and sometimes those reductions.
Mm-hmm. Dan, just thoughts on managing rash. You know, we as oncologists give a lot of medication that gets a rash on board. Do you think it's an overly aggressive, you know, plan to do an immediate hold and potential dose reduction and a grade 2 rash? Or do you think we're spot on there?
Yeah, you know, grade two rash is symptomatic. So it's usually over a decent size of the body and can be associated with, you know, pruritus and itching. So this is where we'll use antihistamines, we'll use our topical steroids, but if I'm concerned, you know, with the onset, it's very quick. You know, we're dosing intermittently anyway, so I don't mind in, you know, holding in a situation where it's a very early rash and I don't know the direction that's going to go. So I'd rather be a little bit cautious there. And then, you know, with the idea that, you know, this may be something that we're able to kind of stay on top of, you know, we kind of, you know, before it recurs very much. And the patient knows what to look for. So the first occurrence, they may be a little bit slow to recognize it. After that, they'll be on top of it. And it does respond to steroids. It does respond to antihistamines. It is reversible. It's generally, you know, low grade in the majority of these cases. So, and, you know, discontinuing because the rash occurred in 5% of the patients. So most of the time, we really don't have to permanently discontinue.
Yeah. Well, that's great advice. I think we're moving on to the video now with Raina and Dr. Love and her conversation and questions.
Dr. Agarwal wanted more information on the use of capivasertib in patients with pre-existing diabetes, and Dr. McKay's next case highlights this challenge.
71-year-old gentleman who presented with a PSA of 85 and bone pain, and workup basically showed Gleason 8 prostate cancer from his prostate biopsy, and he had a PSMA PET scan with widespread bony metastases, retroperitoneal adenopathy. He's got type 2 diabetes. He's on metformin. His last hemoglobin A1C was 7.4, and blood sugars fasting are kind of ranging in the 140 to 160 range. He is obese. His BMI is 31. Has a GFR that's at right around 55. And so he's diagnosed with de novo high volume metastatic prostate cancer. If you were going to do capivasertib, you know, how would you co-manage? He doesn't have an endocrinologist. He's just kind of managed by his primary care around his diabetes. And he's on oral metformin. Does he go on a GLP-1 and you manage his metabolic syndrome in that manner? We actually made the decision to put him on relugolix darolutamide. We're holding off on chemotherapy at the present time, more so of a choice matter than anything else.
Any other questions for the faculty related to tolerability of capivasertib?
Dr. George, you're going to be presenting data at this meeting on the quality of life from Capitello. How do you think that's going to inform interpretation of the AE data? You know, the way we capture AEs is somewhat problematic in the context of clinical trials. Somebody has a grade 3 tox, even if that grade 3 tox is resolved within a short period of time and they go on to stay on therapy for a protracted period of time and doing well, like they're labeled as having a grade 3 tox. So I'm curious how the quality of life data that you presented is going to overlay with the tox data that was previously presented at ESMO.
If you could, would lutetium be something you would offer to him?
You know, that's a very good point. It's definitely something that I would have discussed because he's high volume. He's got widespread bony mets. He's symptomatic. I probably would definitely have that discussion with this individual. You know, one of the biggest questions is, do people need all 6 doses?
I mean, really, it's all of the questions that we would face, but I think this topic, and I'm going to actually ask a question from the audience in terms of, you know, we have Abby Pred with this now. Is this, you know, Kareem, I just wonder, the question here is, why did we pair it with Abby? Could it have been a different RP partner that would not have prednisone on board?
Well, you have to pay attention to drug-drug interaction. I believe capivasertib is metabolized by CYP3A4, so you need to be cautious with drugs dealing with VAS. And this is probably why we made this decision. Also, when we set the trial, we already had the latitude data and the STAMPI data with abiraterone, not necessarily all data from all AR pathway inhibitors that we have nowadays. So, and generally speaking, abiraterone has minimal drug-drug interaction. It also applies to mostly to darolutamide, but again, at this time, darolutamide was clearly not available for these men.
Yeah, I think it's one of the challenges in drug development and what is available and what isn't. But drug-drug interaction, clearly so. I think here, Dan. Questions on the patient-related outcomes that we just seen, and just what your thoughts are in terms of the adverse events data presented. Yeah.
So I think there's a couple of points I just want to follow up on. Elizabeth did a really nice job of presenting this, but in the interest of time, kind of left out a couple of details. One, the onset of this toxicity is relatively early, as we talked about. Hyperglycemia is a little bit later, you know, within the first 2 months, so it's not right off the bat. So you have a chance to control rash and diarrhea before hyperglycemia comes on. And so there's a little sequence there. The second thing is that, again, this is a patient that needs additional therapy. I mean, this is an aggressive disease. This is P10 deficient disease. And frankly, this is a patient I would be given a GLP-1 to even if they didn't have prostate cancer. Mm-hmm. I mean, just because of the obesity and the diabetes that's poorly controlled, mm-hmm. I mean, this is a patient that can really benefit from that. Adding the hormonal therapy, even darolutamide and relugolix, is going to add to that diabetes, poor control, and obesity. So adding a GLP-1 here makes sense regardless of whether or not you're going to use capivasertib. But using capivasertib here is absolutely reasonable. And with a GLP-1 on board, you should be able to control this. Metformin, you know, GLP-1, you shouldn't really need to have to use insulin. We had a relatively low incidence of conversion to insulin mm-hmm. on this study. Only, again, 1% of patients had to stop because of hyperglycemia. There were plenty of patients who had diabetes. Our threshold was 8. Patients like this were absolutely eligible. Mm-hmm. So I would feel comfortable treating this patient. Again, I don't think he's going to die from his diabetes. He's going to die from his prostate cancer and this mm-hmm. aggressive disease in probably the next 3 to 5 years. Yeah. So to me, this is something we have to be comfortable managing because it's a cancer that we can't control.
Yeah. Kareem, I think this is the last question then for you. If lutetium 177 was available as sort of anticipated, how are we going to put it all together? What are we going to do?
Well, first, you know, to be frank, and I'm a member of the steering committee of a trial of PSMA addition, I think I was a bit disappointed by the data, to be really frank, because obviously lutetium PSMA works, clear benefit in CRPC, post-RP, post-taxane, 40% reduction in the risk of death. It also works pre-docetaxel, clear benefit in RPFS, clear benefit in quality of life, et cetera, et cetera, and OS is of the box just because we crossed over almost all patients. But the magnitude of the benefit we're seeing in metastatic hormone-sensitive disease is actually much lower than at least what I was expected. Maybe I was expected too much, but I'm telling frankly what I think. Yeah. It may actually be that we made a mistake starting the hormonal agents first, and then after 1 month or two, when actually the PSMA expression goes down, we randomize patients to receive drug, yes or no. And hence, potentially, this magnitude of benefit, which is not the one I was expected. So I'm not convinced in general with the data we have. It's only RPFS without anything else. And this would probably apply to this gentleman. Now, having said that, I'd be very happy to better understand whether ideally targeting PSMA when the expression is present would make sense in a patient with P10 loss, maybe on top of what we discussed today.
Yeah. Well, I think we've had a very robust discussion this evening on an emerging topic. All of you in the audience and online participated in really learning about new ways that we can enhance our patient selection so that we can provide the right treatment at the right time. And I think that's the exciting part about discovery of a, not just a new pathway, but a way to actionably do something about a pathway that's been around for many, many decades. And I'd just like to thank my two folks on the stage here, Kareem and Dan, as well as those of you here live in person and as well as online, for a really wonderful evening of discussion and conversation on this very topic. Thank you so much for attending and have a wonderful evening.